Hello, and welcome to the Family Law Podcast brought to you by Pump Court Chambers. This series is going to be a selection of ad hoc specials, primarily due to the complications of tiny humans. But what a special we have today. The law in relation to cohabitees is widely acknowledged to be lacking. Anyone specialising in talaata for cohabiting couples knows that an excess of legal complexity, coupled with a serious lack of general awareness for the average cohabiting couples, causes massive difficulties and frequently huge legal fees. The perception, for example, that common law marriage exists is something which causes family lawyers to despair and clients to writhe in horror when they hear the bad news. Luckily, Resolution's Cohabitation Committee is on a mission to change all that, and I'm joined by two of their superstars to talk through their part of Resolution's vision for family justice. So, firstly, I have Graham Fraser, who is head of family and a partner at BBS Law, incorporating OGR Stock Denton, with frankly a scary level of experience. His recent family law cases include the seminal decision of P&Q, which has become to family loans what SS and NS became to spousal maintenance. Graham sits on the Resolution Cohabitation Committee, amongst many other committees, actually. And I'm also joined by Victoria Clark, who is also head of family and a partner at Elite Law. She is a crypto queen, the go-to for divorce lawyers for disputes involving cryptocurrency. She also sits on the cohabitation committee with Graham and has authored the committee's precedent separation agreements for unmarried couples. So welcome to both of you, and thank you very much for being here.
Hello, Mark. Thank you for that lovely introduction.
Thank you for having us.
We try to make people think that, our guests know what they're talking about. And so I'm going to really start at the very, very basic level, and I'll ask Graham this first. When I've mentioned the vision for family justice, I wonder whether you could give our listeners a rundown of what that is.
Well, the vision for family justice is really a series of headline points that Resolution launched last November in preparation for the next UK general election, which is going to happen sometime over the next 12 months. And it covers a range of topics. But for the purposes of this podcast, what we're really looking at is recognizing the changing face of families. And in relation to unmarried couples, the headline points are essentially that the law relating to cohabiting partners on separation needs to be reformed. Secondly, that Schedule 1 of the Children Act 1989 should be reviewed to better meet the needs of children of a cohabiting relationship in the same way as children of a married relationship. And thirdly, that legal rights for cohabitants on death are improved.
Thank you. That seems like a very neat summary, Graham. And Victoria, before we get to the law reform that Graham's talked about, I think it's right, having read through the vision for family justice, that actually another thing that's being mentioned almost across the board is that pre-proceedings in any form just need a radical overhaul. I think there's mentions of replacing MIAMS with AIMS, advice and information meetings. Is that right?
Yeah, I think what we're trying to move away from is encouraging an opportunity for more litigation in the court arena. I think there is an encouragement of people recognizing their vulnerabilities, but also being encouraged to resolve those in the least acrimonious way possible. And that really ties in with Resolution's overarching goal, which is to try and make what is already a difficult process as easy as it can be for the people that are involved in it.
And Graham, it's right, isn't it, that whilst mediation, of course, is really suitable and actually helps to diffuse a lot of situations, what the guide says is it's not necessarily helpful to shove everyone straight into mediation, for example, if they haven't already had legal advice.
Yeah, absolutely right. I think the issue here is getting early legal advice when clients first come to see their lawyers, at which point they can go down the right track. And mediation is one of the avenues to go down, but there are many other types of legal help and assistance out there. So it's about getting the balance right at the beginning of the case, and particularly for unmarried couples. I think a lot of the mischief that we see later on could be resolved by awareness of legal rights and getting that early information and advice. And sensible dialogue at an early stage.
Definitely.
Yeah, I mean, I've got two follow-up points on that. I suppose the first thing is that when you see this things like the mediation voucher scheme, I think what the guide is saying, well, if you're going to put money into free stuff, then part of that should be funding early legal advice as well. And then
Absolutely.
the other point just coming out of that is you talk about raising awareness for unmarried couples. Obviously, that's the focus of this podcast. Is it something for you and for you, Victoria, thinking, well, awareness needs to be raised, not just at separation, but actually in advance? What can we do to dispel the myth of the common law marriage, for example?
Yeah, I agree. And I think, that's why, as a committee, one of the things we've been working hard on is actually getting out into the schools. So looking at spreading education and awareness at a younger age, so that when these children are getting into the community and they're starting to think about long-term relationships and settling down with somebody, they already understand what that means and what that looks like. And one of the analogies I've used on other platforms where we've talked about this in the last 6 months is when you've got a couple choosing whether to have a wedding or whether to purchase their first home with each other, they are leaning towards the latter because that seems to be much more sensible in the long term, and they don't truly understand the implications of that. And so it really is a case of people understanding before they've even started that relationship what it means and what rights they have. And I'm sure Graham will agree with me in saying that we have so many people that come into our office with this misapprehension of a common law marriage, or because they've been together for 25 years and they have two children with each other, it means they have some sort of rights. And there's nothing harder than having to sit in front of somebody who really is left with nothing and having to explain to them that, we are in a society where our law considers that to be acceptable.
Graham, do you think that conveyancing solicitors have a larger part to play in terms of when people are buying properties to really make clear if you say joint tenants, then that is still an express declaration of trust that is still going to be looked at as 50-50 realistically?
And I think during the course of my career, that has improved. I mean, there are now the forms that are used on conveyancing, and that followed the second Bowden case. It's the right focus at that time. And I think the issue is that I think too many conveyancers don't really want to depress the purchasers because it's supposed to be a happy experience, particularly if they're at the beginning of the relationship. Buying a property together is supposed to be a happy experience. So I think psychologically there seems to be an issue there. But the reality is that under the current law, which probably people listening to this know is very, very complex, that people can fall into error right at the beginning in terms of being clear as to their intentions as to how they're going to hold their property. And the fact is that statistically, not enough people enter into bespoke declarations of trust and cohabitation agreements at the beginning. And if they had done so, they would find that the situation would be much easier later on. And that's really just a good example of actually planning financially during the relationship as well.
So Victoria, when we, I think most of our listeners will know this, but just in case they don't, when we talk about law reform for cohabiting couples, what's the headline element that needs reforming?
I think what we're really trying to push is not necessarily cohabitees having the same rights as married couples, but at least looking at there being some sort of reform so that people who are vulnerable within a relationship are not left without even basic legal rights if they separate. So we're not coming in and saying, well, everybody that's been living with each other for 2 years is basically a married couple. But there has to be a middle ground where, if you've been with someone for, say, I don't know, a decade, and you've given up your job and you've had two children with somebody and you're living in a home that's in that person's sole name, there has to be some recognition that you are financially vulnerable as an individual. Now, you know, for those legal people listening to this podcast, I'm sure the first thing they would say is, well, you've got a Schedule One Children Act claim if you've got kids together, so off you go, you're fine. But if your children are 17 and a half, then there's not really much scope you have for protection for yourself. So I think it's trying to find a way to hear the people that say, I've chosen not to get married for a reason. I don't want to be bound by laws. And if I wanted to be, I'd put a ring on it. But then there's also the other side of that, of people who genuinely think they are making a commitment to each other, but don't realize until the end that that commitment actually isn't there. And just to pick up on something Graham said about, you know, conveyances wanting to be positive and not wanting to have that difficult conversation, I think that ties into, you know, the reluctance for people to get a will, because it's almost like, well, if I'm thinking about that document, it means I think it's going to happen just around the corner. And, you know, one of the things I say to clients who have prenuptial agreements or, you know, cohabitation agreements is, this isn't a document I want you to have to rely on. This is a document I'd like you to put in a drawer and never have to look again, much the same as a lasting power of attorney. You don't put that in place because you're expecting to lose capacity. You do it because if it happens, you're protected. And I think the same sort of attitude needs to be taken here. We're not putting regulation in place because we're expecting you to break up with each other. We're putting it in place to protect you if the worst does happen.
Thank you very much. Graham, how does that tie in, this reform of if you're living together for a certain period of time, that there's basic rights? How does that tie in with the traditional form of property ownership of tenants in common, joint tenants, etc.?
Well, I think navigating oneself through constructive trust, followed by expert accounting, working out constructive trust, quantifying and so forth, is incredibly complex. It's complex to me, and I've been doing this work now getting on for over 25 years. So I don't know how normal people cope. And if they're normal people, lay people, the law is just impossible to navigate. So what we need is a much clearer, simpler remedy that can be used in the field of family law. So by doing that, we can then get the remedies for people who need them, and also have the greatest shot of getting fairness in the sense of family law fairness, and then getting families and their children to move on in their lives. At the moment, what we have when there's a dispute and there isn't clarity, well, if we get clarity, sometimes it's clarity in property law, which comes over as being extremely unfair in certain situations in a family context. And if you haven't got clarity, what you have is risk, uncertainty, and frankly, bad law. And therefore, if you're trying to resolve this, and skilled family lawyers will always try and resolve matters, we can't resolve them well, because in terms of knowing what is the right sense of fairness, that's not the sense of fairness under the law. And just to pick up on what Victoria said, what we're not saying is that this is giving the same rights as married couples, because that's not what's proposed in legislation since the 2007 Law Commission report and several private members' bills. What we're looking at is providing basic protection for couples in a certain situation, and that's the situation that crops up that we've talked about, where people come into our office and they discover it's too late to actually change the situation, because it all comes down to what may have happened during a conversation or an email or a text message maybe 10 or 15 years ago, and they're being pinned down to that. And that, frankly, just doesn't seem a very fair way of dealing with things, and it's completely different to what would happen under matrimonial law. And frankly, I say the law's been bad since, well, it was bad before Burns and Burns, which was 1983, wasn't it? But it's also got worse, I think, since the White and White decision, which is now getting on for 25 years ago, where we're trying to avoid discrimination between those who go out to work and those who look after children. And we shouldn't really be having those discussions nowadays. So it's kind of embarrassing that we are still having those discussions. And just also to pick up another point, in terms of raising awareness, we will always have to make people aware of what the law is, but we will do a much better job of making people aware when the laws are better.
Laws there, yeah.
Of course, I mean, I agree with you. This conflict. I think it's law on sham. I think it's A&A, a Mumby decision, where he talks about that the law must be consistent across all the divisions of the High Court. You know, you can't have one law on sham in the Chancery Division, another in the Family Division. It seems to me almost analogous that if you have a couple who are in a close relationship and co-own a property, the fact that in the Chancery Division and the Family Division, there's going to be potentially wildly different outcomes. I appreciate, obviously, the differentiating factor is they've agreed to get married, and that is key, but it just seems outdated, like you say. One of the things that Victoria mentioned was Schedule One, and it's not really the kind of catch-all provision that it seems like. Firstly, obviously, as Victoria said, because if your children are of an age where it's going to be virtually useless, but then also, of course, because any provision is generally on trust and not outright, so it doesn't really help you once your children are gone anyway. Part of the Vision for Family Justice talks about updating Schedule One to reflect modern families. And Victoria, I wonder whether you could just expand on that a little bit.
There's definitely a look at recognizing where children are involved. There is vulnerability both for the children and also for the primary carer of those children. And I think, we need to be cautious about not leaning too much towards the presumption that that's always going to be the woman in the relationship. It could be the man as well. And one of the difficulties that we do still have is just assuming that the mother is going to be the person who's going to need financial provision made for her. But I think, for me personally, I don't have children. I don't plan to have any children. But I think it would be a great shame for people who have been in a long-term relationship that don't have children are seen as not vulnerable in themselves just because they've not made that sacrifice and had those, well, not sacrifice, but because they've not had that life decision to have those children. So I definitely think it's moving in the right direction that if under Schedule One there's provision made for the carer of those children, and that isn't something that has to be retrospectively returned or, as you say, put on trust. But I do still think there's a big window, there's a big gap of people who have not had children, but have still been in that long-term relationship and have still made those sacrifices. What happens if you have a couple that have been together for a very long time and they are infertile and they can't have children, even though they want to, and that relationship breaks down and they're left vulnerable? How heartbreaking would it be for that person to have given up everything, still not have been able to have that child that they so dearly wanted, and then the relationship breaks down, which, let's face it, might be because they can't have children together, and then that person really is left with absolutely nothing. So, they could have spent thousands and thousands of pounds on IVF, for example. So I definitely think recognizing the carer of the children under Schedule One is moving in the direction we want it to move into. But I personally don't think that that's ticking the right box.
Yeah, I agree. Schedule One is not the sticking plaster. There is obviously the need for separate reform. Graham, just a question in terms of Schedule One reflecting modern families. One of the things that I come across a reasonable amount is a modern family structure where there are two people where they one of the parents, but not officially a parent, is the thing. They care for the child, they assume responsibility for the child, but they don't have the status of legal parent. Now, I don't think Schedule One prevents this, but the case law, a decision of Mr. Justice Moylan then, it was a same-sex marriage, surrogacy arrangement, I think, or no, sorry, artificial insemination, and the non-biological mother of the child could not be sued for financial support under Schedule One because she wasn't a legal parent. Even though paragraph 4, subsection 2 of the, or subparagraph 2 of the Schedule 1 actually provides a gateway criteria for additional considerations. If it's not against a parent, case law seems to be interpreting that extremely restrictively. And I wonder whether part of modernizing Schedule 1 is to broaden that definition of parent somewhat.
Yeah, I've heard it said not just by you, Mark, by other counsel, that Schedule One in terms of how the legislation looks nowadays is discriminatory and possibly in breach of human rights legislation. So, I mean, there's a clear case for changing Schedule 1. My buzz line on this is that we are now approaching 25 years in the first quarter of the 21st century, and we're in a situation where the children of unmarried couples suffer considerably compared to the children of married couples. Why is this happening? I scratch my head. It should not be happening. We should not even be having this conversation. However, it does exist. It needs to change. I think it could be changed relatively quickly. However, my view, and I think the view of resolution, has consistently been that we need wholesale reform, because if we get wholesale reform, we can deal with cohabitants in mass. And we need to be really recognizing how many people this is affecting in the country now. It's now 1 in 5 couples projected by 2031. It will be here soon enough. 1 in 4 couples, and half of children are now born to unmarried mothers. So we're dealing with such a high population group that we urgently need laws to deal with them, and laws that are effective and work, and that we don't have to have this discussion. And I probably don't need to tell you, Mark, but my experience of Schedule 1, when you can get them off the ground, which is actually quite rare, because I think it was said that about 700,000 people earn above £156,000 in this country. That was an estimate. So it's a pretty low group. When you get them off the ground and you actually get to directions, hearings and so forth, it's actually quite limited what you can do, because I actually see council having to do things that are quite inventive just to push the claim along. And that clearly is no good. We don't really want to have legislation that is disabled in that way. We need to have legislation that works. So, you know, we need to change Schedule 1 across the board anyway, but more importantly, let's just get the cohabitation reforms that work for everybody who is in that situation.
Yeah, I agree. I think one other point to coming out sort of separate to the reform of cohabitation is Victoria, a suggestion of a dual jurisdiction for child maintenance, i.e. you can apply to the family court for child maintenance, not just be bound by the CMS.
Yeah, I mean, I think that would help significantly, not least because I am certainly finding CMS decisions, particularly since the start of the pandemic, have been incredibly unpredictable. So I'm starting to, I mean, I've got several tribunal cases in my file cabinet now, whereas before 2020, I think I could count the number of tribunal applications that I've made on one hand. And they're just making really odd decisions. You know, they are miscalculating your starting income for maintenance and then saying that the correct is within 25%, so they're not going to change their initial calculation. I've got parents paying for children who are over the age of 18 and they're not in full-time education anymore. They're impossible to get hold of and they're incredibly difficult to work with. And contrastingly, the people who are claiming maintenance, they're being faced with parents who are just, if you don't give an address to the child maintenance service, the CMS tells the receiving parent that the paying parent can't be contacted and so payment can't be made, even though they may already have an email address and a telephone number. So there are ways for the paying party to frustrate the process, and there are ways for a paying party to become vulnerable to something that actually is wholly inaccurate. And I, you know, there are lots of people in this world that don't earn enough money for the payment to be over £3,000 a month. And so there is just never a scenario where you're entering the court arena to have that conversation. And I think it's really important that that is something that should be looked at. You've also got multi-jurisdictional parents where one parent lives in one country and the other parent lives here. Now, if you have a paying parent that lives in a European country and is earning money based on that tax system and that maintenance system, but they are subject to the English child maintenance system, they're paying an absolute fortune in maintenance that they just can't afford because the CMS doesn't care what they're earning and spending in the country of origin. So I think actually having a vehicle through the court system to sort out maintenance is going to be helpful on multiple levels, you know, to try and beef up that support for people where the CMS is insufficient, but also giving people another avenue to actually identify what these children do need. Because the other thing I was just thinking about is, you know, with Schedule One, if you've been divorced, Schedule One is your second bite of the cherry if you need a bit more for the children. Whereas if you haven't ever been married, Schedule One is really the only vehicle that you have. So not only do cohabitees have very little opportunity, but actually people who have been married have two opportunities of where they can try and seek some sort of financial support.
Yeah. I mean, of course, if the paying parents abroad, they're not bound by the CMS. It's just that we still tend to use the calculator, don't we? So
well, I mean, my experience of working with the CMS is if the child is living in this country, the CMS determines what maintenance should be paid to that child. And so if you're living in a REMO country, the CMS will enforce the calculation from this country in that country. And it is for you to then challenge it if you are saying that it is unaffordable. But the starting position is if the child is here, the maintenance calculation is here, irrespective of what the paying parent is earning in the country of origin. And if they choose to ignore it, then you just have to keep your fingers crossed that they're in a country that recognises REMO. Otherwise, you're really restricted. You know, I have a case at the moment where the paying parent is living in a non-REMO country and they do not want to work with CMS calculations. So it's really having to explore what that parent actually has as options in front of them.
Yeah, I mean, of course, I've got tribunal case going on at the moment and same experience, Victoria. They looked at all the money going into my client's bank account and assumed that was all income, despite the fact that his tax returns say otherwise. And at no point have HMRC said, you're not declaring all your income. So it's quite extraordinary. Graham, how would this work, the parallel jurisdiction, in terms of, I mean, obviously we've got the guidance from Mr. Justice Mostyn in terms of James and Seymour, that his adjusted formula methodology, he says apply the CMS calculator below 156 for cases where the CMS don't have exclusive jurisdiction. Is the idea of a parallel jurisdiction so that the family court has more discretion applies those Schedule One factors?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just going to comment really that I found child maintenance, child support, whatever you call it, it's an unmitigated, unfortunate, embarrassing disaster, isn't it? That is the elephant in the room of all our cases. And people don't like using the service. I don't think the people who work for the service particularly enjoy it. I think it's just shameful, really. And presumably nothing's going to be done about it. But I think really where we're coming from in terms of family lawyers and the courts is doing something when it comes to financial provision for children, which really means that the children get the support that they need and also the parents. So that could be, you know, extending sort of carers' allowances, as it were. It could mean providing greater flexibility on maintenance, that you actually encroach the area of providing maintenance for an unmarried partner where that is going to provide assistance for a child. And it could mean providing greater flexibility in terms of pension provisions in certain circumstances. But you see, by doing all of those, if you just deal with Schedule One in isolation, you're getting very close to what I've been talking about, which is you have cohabitation law, specific statute, and you cover the whole thing off. But I suppose the quickest way forward is that you simply just give children of unmarried couples exactly the same rights as children of married couples, and you just make simple changes in legislation. But I think it's all about providing more flexible remedies so that they work better on the ground. Because at the moment, as I say, you're going around and you're trying to seal the cracks. And if you're fortunate to be in practice, like I think all of us are, and we work on cases with other lawyers, We try our best to work around the system, but we've got to do better than that. We've got to actually have laws that are working and actually make a difference. Because I'm really concerned that they don't. And it's the fathers. It's usually the fathers. It's the fathers who are, frankly, getting away with it. And actually, people who oppose cohabitation reform actually agree with us about this. So why are we, as I say, why are we still discussing it? It's an embarrassment and we need to change it.
Yeah, I agree. And I think another issue, particularly for our clients, because obviously they're the ones that have to understand all of this, is the Child Maintenance Tribunal, just to come back to Victoria's experience of that, it's the Wild West. I mean, the law's all over the place. There's no set procedure. When I've appeared in there, that they've sent the bundle out in paper form to no address in particular, so everyone's got different sets of papers, and everyone there is working as much as they can, and it's the people in the system aren't the problem, but the system just seems massively flawed. And at least the family court has a coherent set of procedure and digitization, for example.
I think that's, isn't, you know, what Graham's saying about, you know, how we try and paper over the cracks. And, you know, when you're in that tribunal, you're trying to just make the best that you can of it. And it reminds me of when, you know, before, several years ago, where they were saying in the House that it was the law, the legal community's responsibility to offer more pro bono work to help cope with LASBO and the loss of legal aid. And it just feels like the burden is on our shoulders to plug the gaps in this sinking boat, when actually all we're asking for is a new one. You know, just all of these little plasters, like you describe, of multi-jurisdictional child maintenance, and let's beef up Schedule One and let's do this. And ultimately it's this, well, the boat is still sinking. So this isn't solving the problem. You know, as Graham's saying, it has to be across the board in order for all of these things to be wrapped up into one. And there's an element of, I don't think people realise just how bad it is, because we as lawyers are trying to make it better for the clients. And, you know, the judges are telling us, you know, tell us when things aren't working, tell us when you're trying to fudge it and you're trying to make it work, because otherwise we don't know that the system is broken. And I think, you know, that's what we're doing now. We're saying, okay, we've had enough now. We've had enough papering over the cracks. We'd like you to actually come out and fix this problem.
Okay, but before I draw this discussion to a close, I know that there are sort of more broader proposals in the Vision for Family Justice, and I don't know, we've probably touched on them, but I don't know whether either of you felt there was something else in that document that should be brought to light in this context.
I think providing early legal advice is a particular focus for resolution, and it has got support of politicians. And that's really about getting the advice to people at the right stage, early enough. And I think also encouraging dispute resolution, not just down the track of mediation, but other forms. I mean, we have lots of processes and ways of working that are genuinely helpful to the public. So I think it's about getting into a dialogue with politicians and so forth, that we modernise our laws and modernise the way we practice. And I, for one, if we have to go to court, and of course we do, which is why you exist, Mark. but when we do go there, I don't want to hear judges saying, I'm not interested about my AMs. I'm not interested whether non-court dispute resolution has been attempted. And in fact, they will have to be interested as from the 29th of April, because the family procedure rules are changing. But also, I don't want to hear judges saying, well, child maintenance has nothing to do with me. Because I think when you're practicing, and when you're lawyers and you go to court and your clients hear that, they think, well, what's the point of the court system? So we do need to have updated laws that work for everyone, and it's outmoded, and some work needs to be done. Now, to get that over the line, we are going to have a sensible and constructive dialogue because these changes ought to appear to be non-controversial. And as an organisation, Resolution is not in the habit of coming up with sort of high-level controversial reforms that's going to shock people to the core. But we have been campaigning since Resolution's inception, I think 40 years ago now, to get these changes. So on the cohabitation side of things, I say that is long overdue, and I'm hoping that after the general election, whenever that comes, there will be a sensible dialogue in terms of a cross-party initiative to get some genuine reforms over the line. Now, before that happens, maybe papering over the facts is the wrong word, but we have a responsibility as practitioners to do the best that we can with the current laws to provide as much justice as possible. And that will come from sensible dialogue, from out-of-court negotiations, and by trying to get this this area of law to work the best that we can. But frankly, I very much hope that if we chat again in a few years' time, we won't be talking about how we find constructive trust in terms of what happened on page 54 of a 350-page bundle, discussing a conversation in a coffee shop 3 days before they entered into exchange of contracts, because that's been my experience of what happens. And I think we've just got to get away from that very old, outdated law, very restrictive laws about children, financial provision for children. And we need to really modernise the law so we get the law to work, because it's a fact that family lawyers tend to settle cases. I don't know how many, I guess, Mark, you do a lot of trials because you're a barrister, but most lawyers in practice settle their cases. And I think the reason why policymakers, lawmakers are really concerned about this is because they think somehow we're opening Pandora's box and the court's going to be flooded with applications. That's just not going to happen with cohabitation law reform. We're not about that. We're about removing the worst injustices. We're really trying to get laws that work. We're trying to get it onto the local ground level, that when people go to mediations or roundtable meetings or have a direct dialogue in their kitchen, they know that they're talking about something that has fair laws in the background. Because when you've got laws that don't work, how are you ever going to get anything resolved? And I do think there's a grey black hole, whatever you want to call it, where many people don't go and see their lawyers, and just some very bad things are happening. Because when you have bad lawyers, they get exploited, and you get into areas like coercion and control. And I do think that in this area of law, people who are economically dominant can exploit that position. So I think we've really got to be careful to protect our society. And I hope that people listening to this can understand why we feel so strongly about it.
Yeah, I mean, well said, Graham. And just one thing to sort of echo is this idea that a law change means more applications. No, if the law is more certain, more cases will settle. The analogy is spousal maintenance in the family court, probably still the hardest thing to advise on in terms of what's going to happen. Greater certainty there will mean less trials, for example. Victoria, before I wrap things up, was there anything else you wanted to add?
No, I think Graham has echoed all of our sentiments very clearly and accurately. We hope that we're not going to have the same conversation with you in 3 years' time.
Well, me too.
I just also want to say that I saw your podcasts, which were, it might have been videos actually, Mark, at the time of No Fault Divorce. And there was an intense scrutiny about how the new rules would work. And I worked on those rules. And I have to say, happily, that hasn't really come to fruition. I've only heard of one reported case, which could have happened before the new rules, which was an international, it wasn't an international case. It was, I think it was expediting the final order. But there you go. We had new law, and we put in new rules, and now people can get divorced. And it's not even in a conversation, is it? So when you get new laws, new rules that work really well, it just works. And that's really what we're trying to achieve.
Yeah, and I agree. It's not a reason not to try it. But thank you very much both for joining. It's been really instructive, and I hope instructive for our listeners as well. I think we'll wrap it there though, because otherwise we'll be spoiling the joy of any listeners for reading The Vision of Family Justice itself. It's only about 36 pages long, and I did find it genuinely interesting as a practitioner, actually. I agreed wholeheartedly with it. I'd say thank you again to my guests, Graham Fraser and Victoria Clark. Thank you to Samara Brackley of Pump Court for setting this up, who is also on the Cohabitation Committee. We will be back slightly on an ad hoc basis, as I said, for reasons at the start, but absence makes the heart grow fonder. Otherwise, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.